Welcome to Engineering Innovations, the official podcast of Purdue University's Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. I'm your host, Kristen Malavenda, the Communications Director for the department. In each episode of Engineering Innovations, I'll sit down with faculty from Purdue ECE to talk about their path to becoming an engineer, focus of their research, and the future of the field. Today's guest is Chris Britton, the Elmore Rising Star Assistant Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering. Chris, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Kristen, for having me.
So we're going to start right at the beginning. How did you end up in electrical and computer engineering?
Yeah, so it's a interesting story. I'd always like for it to be some like very glamorized notion of being so interested in electricity and computers right. When I was growing up. It really wasn't as much that. I mean, I've always certainly played my share of computer games and also played the electric guitar, which is something I like to still do in my spare time. But I would say more than anything, what brought me to ECE was just an interest in mathematics. So I've always really liked math, and I like to see how I could use math or apply math to do and solve some interesting problems. And ECE seemed like a really great place to do that. When I started college, I was, perhaps undecided exactly which track of engineering.
But you know, it was engineering.
I knew it was engineering. Actually early on, I did consider switching to math. I'm happy I didn't.
Yeah.
Just some of the introductory classes, I wasn't, not at Purdue. I didn't do my undergrad at Purdue. I didn't like some of those like engineering drawing classes that they had us do
right.
and everything.
But yeah.
In a way that was probably the reason why I went to ECE, because we don't have to do really nice hand drawings.
Okay.
So I was never too good.
You're
at
like
that.
That's for me.
Exactly.
So it's not that long since you were in school. What's different about your educational experience compared to the students you're teaching today?
Well, I went to a much smaller school, definitely. You had a much larger teacher to student ratio, I guess. So that's one thing, but that wouldn't have been different over time. I mean, that's just a fact of the school. Actually, I've grown to really like large schools a lot. I like to have the kind of diversity of students in the classroom, which I didn't see as much, I guess, when I was an undergraduate. One thing is that, but again, that's not really like a time thing, but over the, let's see, I graduated in 2011. So over the last 12 years, I mean, certainly COVID's happened, right? That's changed a lot. I think one thing is probably the more use of technology, not necessarily in the classroom, but outside of the classroom, right? Back when I was a student, it was almost unheard of to have your lectures recorded. And now that's becoming much more commonplace. I mean, I do it for my students. And when I'm teaching today, I try to find ways to encourage students to come to class. And I actually view that as a challenge that I want to solve as an educator. How do I motivate students to come to class even though my lectures are recorded so they can get them online later?
Right.
The lecture notes are posted.
Yeah.
And all that. They can discuss on Piazza or whatever. I mean, we didn't really have any of that when I was, when I was an undergraduate. It's becoming much more challenging to encourage students to come to class today. Yeah. Whereas back when I was a student, it was, if you didn't show up for the lecture, you weren't going to hear the lecture.
Right? I think the other good thing about that is it helps all different learning styles because I used to carry one of those little digital recorders and record my professor's lectures because I needed to hear it again. So, but I can see how that would be a challenge. Be like, I'll just stay asleep and watch it later or something like that.
Right, exactly. Especially the early morning classes.
Yeah.
Over the course of this semester, I mean, I think probably every professor, I don't think it's just me, maybe it is, but you end up just having a drop in your attendance.
Right? Yeah.
The first couple of weeks are always much more attended.
Yeah.
And always the exams, right? That's when you see everybody like, okay.
You're like, wait a minute, you're in this class?
Exactly.
So how did you end up in academia over industry?
Well, so I took a bit of an interesting path. So I finished my PhD in 2016. And I always kind of knew that I wanted to be a professor. I just always liked the idea. I like to teach a lot, and I like doing research a lot. So what better way to do both those things than to be in academia? But when I finished my PhD, I actually didn't come directly to academia. So I started a company. It's actually a machine learning for education company.
Oh, okay.
It's called Zoomy. Zoomy is still actually around today. Zoomy looks at personalized and adaptive educational solutions. I really learned a lot, in my time there, just about, certainly how to manage a team, something I, didn't do as a graduate
right.
student, but I was managing a research group. We weren't necessarily focused on publishing papers as much as we were on doing research based on what customers wanted to look into and all that.
Right.
But I learned a lot of skills that I think brought to my career here at Purdue. I certainly learned how to talk to investors. I mean, I don't
right.
talk to investors now as much as I talk to, program managers
yep.
who potentially fund my research.
Right.
But a lot of those skills I think are transferable in terms of understanding how to really explain the significance of your work.
Right.
Before I came to Purdue, I was also lectured. I did my PhD at Princeton, and so I went back there and I was a lecturer for about 2 years while I was also at Zoomy during that time. And then I finally, 2019, came to Purdue. So it was all kind of part of my path, but it was great to experience that and just kind of realize that I did want academia to be my home base.
Right. Yeah. So what drew you to Purdue?
You know, it's just such a great engineering school. I mean, we're top ranked. I mean, top four in engineering overall. EC is always consistently top 10.
Yeah.
9, 8, 10. I'm not sure exactly where
yeah.
we are right now. Somewhere there. When I interviewed here, I really liked it a lot. I liked everybody that I met with. I felt like they were all quite nice. They were very friendly. It seemed like a very collaborative environment,
yeah.
which is something I like to collaborate in my work. It seemed like that was something I was going to be able to do here. So at first, the idea of coming to a big school, right? Because even Princeton ECE is actually their biggest department on campus too.
Oh, okay.
But proportionally, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if Princeton ECE was here, it would be one of the smaller departments
right.
at Purdue. And EC here is, probably three times.
And growing.
Yeah, and growing. Mm-hmm. I think it's three times. Maybe. I don't know exactly what it was. I think Princeton has like 40 to 50 faculty now. So
oh, and we have
three times.
We're approaching like 150.
Yeah, yeah, right. So we're about three times the size, yeah. something like that.
Yeah.
So I was a little intimidated to come to such a big school, but I've had it to be an advantage in many ways because I always get to kind of meet new people.
Yeah.
I mean, now I think I know everybody's name and all the faculty's names. But
that would be amazing.
I think I do now. I think if you show me pictures of everybody, I probably know all their names.
Yeah.
Now, but it took me till this point.
Yeah.
And COVID certainly didn't help with that.
No, it didn't. I've been here. I think I've been in ECE for 6 years, and I haven't even met some of the faculty because there's just so many that, it's crazy.
Yeah. Some of them I haven't even met, but I just would know who they are just based on the work they've done.
Right.
And sort of the prominence that they've achieved in their field.
Yeah. So speaking of research, I know one focus of your research is fog learning.
Yeah.
That relates to machine learning, which you were talking about. Explain what fog learning means.
Sure.
And why it's important.
Sure. Happy to. So to understand the concept of fog learning can just talk about the way machine learning has traditionally worked. Machine learning has gotten such fantastic advances, especially over the past decade. You hear something new every day, right, about what's going on now. Large language models, right? They're all the fuzz with ChatGPT,
right,
and everything. And so the way that machine learning has traditionally worked is that all the data that's necessary to train these models, learn these models, whether it's a large language model or some kind of neural network, some other kind of neural network. I mean, they're all neural nets in some form, but is take the data and centralize it somewhere in a data center, cloud, AWS, whatever it happens to be, and train, crank out the models there. right? So what's happened in kind of a trend over the last 1 to 2 decades, really with the rise of user-generated data in so many different applications that we have today on our smartphones and everything else. You have user-generated and you have machine-generated data for different things. So the data is so distributed now. I mean, it's sitting on my phone, right? It's sitting on your phone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sitting on, you know, anything around campus that's collecting data.
Right.
You know, I always like to think of those, the little robots that send around food.
And, yep.
You know, they capture some forms of data, right? Because they have to be able to see and know what's going on.
Right.
So all this data is distributed, and but we'd like to be able to use all of it to train models. So there's two like fundamental problems with that. So one is that it actually costs a lot in terms of communication resources to send all that data to some central place.
Okay.
If you think about every single device needing some kind of energy amount to be able to send that data up. And at the same time, another, in some ways, perhaps even bigger challenge to that is privacy concerns, right? So users don't want to just share their data with anybody.
Right.
They like to know where it's going, and they like to know who has access to it. I mean, we see all issues all the time with data breaches, security breaches, and so on, password leaks,
right,
and everything. So the idea of federated learning is, it's not quite fog learning. I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
The idea of federated learning is let's get around this problem by letting the devices themselves do the training on their local data sets.
Okay.
All right. So I'm going to let my phone do the training. I'm going to let the little robot running around campus do the training on whatever local processor it has on its own limited data set. And then instead, what I'm going to use the server for in the data center is to aggregate the models.
Okay.
So we have all these models being trained. Let's aggregate them, synchronize them back down, keep training, aggregate, synchronize. It's an iterative process, right?
They keep
going back and forth. The idea being the models should be significantly smaller than the data itself, and also significantly more privacy preserving than the data itself. So federated learning achieved a lot of popularity, especially Google pioneered it in a way. And there's been so much work on it. I mean, thousands and thousands of papers over the last, maybe not 10 years, but 8 years, seven, 8 years, is this concept. I mean, everything from convergence analysis to experimentation and really trying to bridge that gap between them. But federated learning itself also has many challenges, right? One is the fact that network structures don't often follow this star topology, we call it, where there's a single central server that's connected to all the devices directly.
Right.
It's in fact more often a hierarchy, right? From the cloud, even potentially like satellites, if we have them in there somewhere, to all the edge devices. There's some hierarchy of computing elements. And so from my edge device here is probably directly connected to some wireless access point that may go out to, some larger access point. If I'm on a cellular connection, it might be a base station. And then there's some elements in the core network before it would actually get to the cloud. Okay. So there's many hops between.
Right.
And that adds a lot of potential like latency issues in terms of getting the data all the way back up. If you viewed it as a star topology, that is. So if you tried to simplify this into that star topology without accounting for the complexities of the hierarchy, federated learning also doesn't account for like potential movement or mobility of devices that maybe are going from one access point to another.
Mm-hmm.
It also doesn't fundamentally account for the fact that all of our data sets are different.
Right.
And as a result, if you wait too long before you do a synchronization, you might have some kind of an overfitting or where a lot of local bias is introduced into your model, which is based on your own data set, but maybe not relevant to a model that somebody else would have. So fog learning is really trying to integrate the concept of federated learning with the concept of fog computing.
Okay.
Which has been around. So fog computing is the idea of handling network and computing tasks over this continuum of resources from the end devices, like cell phones, Internet of Things devices, all the way up through the hierarchy to the cloud data centers.
Gotcha.
Right. So you have the edge and you have the cloud.
Yep.
right? And then the fog is kind of an analogy term for that. What's between, what's separating right. us from the clouds, right?
I gotcha.
The fog, right?
Yeah.
I didn't come up with that term, but but it's been around. And so fog learning is trying to look at what federated learning is like over that type of a structure, over this cloud to things continuum. And so there's a lot of challenges related to dealing with data heterogeneity, dealing with the realistic topology aspects, dealing with potential ad hoc communication structures you want to introduce in fog learning. So it kind of trying to define a field based on that.
Gotcha. Now, I'm sure everybody's doing research. You hit a roadblock every once in a while. How do you get around those roadblocks? And how do you communicate to your students that just because you hit that roadblock doesn't mean you're a failure?
So that's the second part of your question is an important answer to the first part of your question,
okay.
I think, because when you, as a professor, we deal with failures all the time, mm-hmm. right? We deal with paper rejections. We deal with proposal rejections. Lots of rejections happen, right? There's probably 3 rejections for every acceptance. I'm not sure. Maybe somebody should study that.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see. but it's, I think when you're a student, it's a little bit different because as a student, you own the work from start to finish mm-hmm. yourself. As a professor, you're not owning and leading the research. You're managing and mentoring the research. So any given rejection, thinking of a paper, perhaps hurts a little bit less.
Okay.
As a professor, because you're not the one owning it. I think, and this would also be a cool thing to study psychologically. Maybe it has been studied. I don't know. Not a psychologist. I believe that the proportion of time that you spend working on something is directly proportional to how much pain it will cause you if it ends up getting rejected.
That makes sense.
I think that it's true.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. So if I had I try to spend time with all my students' papers, a lot of time with all of them. But some of them, of course, I have something else going on. So maybe I didn't get as much time to spend, editing this paper as I did with another paper and so on. So to me personally, the ones that hurt more are the ones that I spent more time with start to finish. But all the student who led it, it's going to hurt for them.
Yeah.
Right. And it can be extremely demoralizing, not motivating. And it's really cliche, but what you have to do is just persevere. I mean, you have to push through it.
Yeah.
You can talk about it. And I think talking it through with them and having them understand this is just one roadblock on a very long journey that you will get past. And, a PhD is kind of a marathon, just like the 10-year process is a marathon.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's one roadblock that you'll get past. And trying to, I think, help them understand. Let me see how to put this. Whether it was their fault or not their fault that it got rejected.
Yeah.
That's another important role, I think.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the student didn't put enough effort into it. And it can be it's a good wake-up call for them because they don't always want to listen to their advisor. I mean, it's fine. I mean, we're all adults.
Yeah.
We all have our own opinions. And sometimes we think that we know better. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Right? So sometimes hearing it from someone else, like a reviewer, hey, this wasn't
right.
That's a good wake-up call.
Yeah.
But there are other times where paper is really good and it just got trashed for whatever reason. I mean, it just got the wrong set of reviewers, or you can read through a reviewer's comments sometimes and realize, hey, this reviewer just really doesn't want this paper published, maybe because they're working on something similar.
Right.
And they're trying to, squash their competition, so to speak. And so helping them understand, never point fingers, but helping them understand that this is all just kind of part of it. And, just encouraging them to keep trying.
Yeah.
And also, I think, give them opportunities. So there are things like beyond even just paper writing that students can get involved with, like that they may become very passionate about one of the projects that you're working on, which produces papers, but maybe some of the engagements with the, whether it's an industry or a government sponsor, maybe they're really good at that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're really good at preparing presentations and explaining the significance of work.
Right.
Is that something you have to do regardless of what career path you choose after? So if they're really good at that, you can expose them to that as well.
Yep.
It kind of helps them not have all their eggs in one basket necessarily. But yeah, I think you just have to...
just keep going.
Generally, you just have to keep going. And also know, like, sometimes you just need to step away a little bit for a day or so.
Right.
And just say, hey, you know what? Gonna kind of refocus myself and, you know, maybe, I guess call them a mental health day.
Yeah.
You know, take one of those. Yeah. Another thing that's helped me a lot is actually exercise. So whether it's, you know, weightlifting or running, a lot of times will help me feel better after when I have something like that going on.
Get that. And also, I think it's important for them to realize whatever roadblock you hit, you've learned something along the way. But,
exactly.
But I know I communicate mostly with undergrads, and they're so hard on themselves.
Yeah.
You know, they really expect a lot of themselves and get disappointed if it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
So when you're looking for students to work on a research project or in your lab or whatever, what qualities do you look for in a student that you say, okay, this person's going to be a good addition?
You know, the number one thing to me is motivation and ambition, because I believe that given that the person has some baseline of skills, right, in mathematics and in engineering, specifically electrical engineering or computer engineering, every problem you look at is going to be different in some way. So you're not always starting from scratch, but you have to be able to know how to pick things up as you go.
Right.
And the only way you're going to be able to do that is if you're not necessarily fully self-motivated, but if you're motivated to take the direction of an advisor. You know, I've worked with students undergraduate or graduate level that they're extremely smart, extremely smart, but they're not necessarily willing to go pick up something else, right? And maybe they're just not as interested in what it is that I'm working on.
Right.
Right. So that's probably my number one criteria. My number two criteria is that, they're going to be working on research that I'm also interested in and have funding for.
Right. Yeah.
Because I actually have this problem quite a bit, is that a lot of students want to come work with me and they want to work on core AI and machine learning topics. Mm-hmm. They want to build the next large language model.
Right.
Right. They want to, well, that's probably the newest thing now. I mean, a lot of people want to do that.
Right.
But I don't really do that, you know?
Yeah.
My work is really looking at how to optimize the training and the delivery of these models better. And also how to then take the state of the art in AI and ML and use that to improve communications and networking. But I like for students to have at least some interest in looking at these systems aspects of the problems, right? Because otherwise, they may get disappointed. I may not be able to help them as well,
right,
as some other professors here might be able to.
Yeah.
So those would probably be my main two things, I would say. I also do differentiate between if I'm hiring a student directly from undergrad versus if I'm hiring a student that has a master's. I kind of look for some differences in qualifications. If you're coming from a master's, I'd like to see that you've published some papers already.
Yep.
Whereas for an undergrad, I mean, expecting that, you know, is maybe not realistic.
Right.
Though we have some undergrads that that do publish.
They absolutely do.
Good.
So since you came to Purdue, I mean, I talk about not knowing all the faculty members. I know you because I'm writing news releases about you all the time. So you received a lot of awards. You've gotten the NSF Career Award, the Office of Natural Resources Young Investigator Program Award, DARPA's Young Faculty Award, Intel's Rising Star Faculty Award, on and on and on. What do these awards mean to you personally, and what does it do for you in terms of continuing and furthering your research?
It means so much. I mean, it's just the greatest and most humbling feeling, and such an honor when you receive any one of these. It's just a really great feeling to know that these agencies respect the work that I'm doing, that my group is doing. in some way or another, many of the awards that you listed all have to do with fog learning, some components of fog learning.
Okay.
Right. So my NSF Career Award is really focused more on like commercial settings of fog learning. My Office of Naval Research Young Investigator Award is much more focused on like defensive settings, right? And say smaller deployments. The DARPA Award's focused actually on satellite communications.
Okay.
So they're all, it shows, I think, that there's a great interest in distributed AI and ML for, you know, advancing the state of the art in intelligence,
mm-hmm.
As well as security purposes. So that's one thing that means a lot, just to know that the work is appreciated.
Yeah.
They come with money too, right? So they support graduate students. And
yeah.
And so that helps a lot in terms of furthering my own agenda, right? Because I can't do anything without my students, right. And postdocs.
Yeah.
They're so great. I mean, they're, you know, constantly working hard, and you know, it allows me to get good people here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's
it's good all the way around.
Yeah, exactly.
So obviously from talking to you, you're working quite a bit and on a bunch of different things. So in your little bit of free time that you have, what do you like to do? You mentioned exercising to recharge and get away from it.
Well, I have two young children. My son Adam is three, coming on 3 and a half now, actually. I have a 4-month-old son, Nate.
Okay.
And so I like to spend time with them as much as I can.
Yeah.
Just to watch them grow. You know, whether it's, you know, watching something on TV with them. I mean, Adam's his favorite show for a while, or favorite movie, was WALL-E for a while.
Oh, wow.
But now he's been watching Shrek, actually.
Okay.
So I've been also getting my share of Disney movies that I hadn't necessarily seen.
Right.
When I was growing up. So watching them grow is just one of the greatest rewards that you can have, I think, you know, beyond anything that I could do in my professional career. So I like spending time with them. You know, I like spending time with my wife as well. You know, as a family together. So try to have family time. I also am a musician. So I've played guitar for a very long time, since I was, before I was a teenager.
Okay.
I'm into all different kinds of music, rock, blues, not so much jazz, actually. People always ask me that. I don't really play jazz music as much, but definitely rock and blues and metal and acoustic and classical and all different forms.
I remember when I did a new faculty spotlight on you, and your answer was something about you like math rock. And I had to have my son explain to me, what is math rock? What is math rock?
Oh, well, you know, I actually, the reason I say that term is just because there's certain bands that I listen to which are associated with math rock, like Rush, for example. Rush is always one of my favorite bands. It's been for a very long time. My first concert I ever went to, my dad took me when I was 15. He took me to, in close proximity, I can't remember which one was first, a Yes concert and a Rush concert.
Wow.
Yes is progressive rock. Rush is also progressive rock. I wouldn't call Yes math rock. Maybe you could call them math rock.
Yeah.
I guess just really intricate progressions of drums, guitar, and bass, all sort of compiled in a way that sounds really nice. Maybe that's the best way to describe math.
There you go. So. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Sure.
It's been a great conversation and fun to have you.
It's my pleasure, Kristen. Thank you so much for all the work you do for ECE. You mentioned that you've written a lot of those news articles for me, and I do appreciate every single one that you write. So thanks very much.
You're welcome. That wraps up this episode of Engineering Innovations. Big thank you again to Chris Brinton for sharing his expertise, passion, and the incredible work happening at the intersection of the physical and virtual. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. Your feedback helps us bring you more captivating conversations with faculty from Purdue University's Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. To stay updated on upcoming episodes and to learn more about Purdue ECE, you can visit our website at purdue.edu/ECE. You can follow us on Facebook, X, Instagram, and LinkedIn. I'll put up links in the show notes for that information, and we'll be back in a month with another episode.